On the first Empire podcast of 2015, we welcome not one, but two possible Best Actor Oscar contenders in the guise of Birdman's Michael Keaton and A Theory of Everything's Eddie Redmayne, while his co-star Felicity Jones, herself an awards contender, also pops in. All that to come, plus the usual movie news and nonsense on the podcast. I saw Cats the other night, and you know what? I don't think I'm Redicle. Foilist Jellicle. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Didn't understand a word of that.
Yeah, stop trying to make Jellicle happen, Cats.
Yeah,
come on.
Utterly baffling. Anyway, hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast in association with Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store for a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Empire. Took us ages to come up with that offer code, but there you go. Empire is the offer code. Joining me after our extended Christmas break, almost 3 weeks away, unbelievable, are three colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our geek queen, a lady whose New Year resolution is to spend less time with Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki. Well, I say resolution, it's more of a court order. Hello, Helen O'Hara, how are you?
I'm very well, Chris. As you know, that's a complete fiction. I've never heard of these Ackles people that you speak of.
Next up is our film fact fiend, a man whose New Year resolution is to find the one unanswerable movie trivia question. For example, what happened to David Spade's career? Not a question. He's very successful, very, very happy. He's on TV. He's all good. He was in Grown Ups 2. I guess that's a movie career. It's Ali Plum.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Excellent. How was your Christmas?
Good, thanks.
Great. And then last but not least, well, my New Year's resolution was to spend more time with my good friend and former neighbour, James White, a.k.a. Jaime Blanco, Empire's West Coast editor. But because I can't be arsed going to L.A., we brought him here. James White, hello, how are you?
Bonjour. Wait, no, that's not Spanish. Anyway,
Jaime Blanco.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with some questions. First question, so 2015. This is from podcast regular NC Lowe at NC Lowe on Twitter, who says, easy one to start the year. What geeky goodies did you get for Christmas? I got a Marvel coloring book. Smiley face. So there you go. I'd love a Marvel coloring book. That'd be amazing. Helen.
My family have bought me a Wonder Woman running outfit. It's made of proper like wicking running fabric, apparently.
Steady, gents.
And is, you know, good for running in, but is also Wonder Woman, so I'm very excited.
Does it come with the
comes with the wristbands, the wristbands, and it has a little cape hanging off the vest top at the back.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool. Will you be doing the spinning thing?
I will be
going Wonder Woman for 26
for 26.2 miles. Yes, I will just
130 tooth. I think you're fine.
That would actually be a hilarious way to do a marathon, just dance around it going, Wonder Woman.
At what point do you think you would die?
132.
Ali, any?
I got a copy of The Room on DVD with a threat on it. And another one, I also got a David Shrigley book, pretty big. He's got a really big new coffee book, which I guess is nerdy if you're into that sort of thing.
Who's David Shrigley?
David Shrigley is one of those comic artists or cartoonists. I don't think you want to be called a cartoonist, but I think he's an artist which could be conceived as being comic, who writes, who draws drawings that are essentially a man staring into an empty morass. And then he, it's just a little stick figure, and then it just says crap above it. It's that level of kind of despairing bleak humour. So yeah, David Shrigley, if you know him, you'll love him. And if you don't know him, we'll then go find out about him, because he's great.
Interesting. Very interesting. Blanco.
Yeah, I got a couple of things. A couple of friends bought me a Star Wars Christmas T-shirt, which is a couple of AT-ATs made up to like reindeer, and one on the front has a Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer nose. Most of my family, extended family, a little bit older, didn't really get it. They're sort of, isn't that just a laser gun at the front? It's like, no, it's Rudolph's nose. He's wearing antlers. Do you not get that this is essentially Santa's team, but AT-ATs? It's fantastic. It says Star Wars on it. Anyway, the other thing I got, not quite a Christmas gift, just a gift I got from someone who is awesome, and that was a massive Marvel encyclopedia of all the characters for when I'm writing new stories and my Marvel comic knowledge doesn't extend quite as far as Chris's. It's growing very quickly, but when I need to refer to some sort of little part of the lore of the Marvel comics, I can just look back and go, oh, this, such and such did this. Or
Peter Parker is Spider-Man.
What?
Sorry,
I haven't got to P.
Spoiler.
I'm only on C.
That's great. That's a great gift. How up to date is it? Is it one? This is like 1970s edition. It's just
It's pretty good, to be honest. I think it was actually updated last year, year before. So it's not bad. It does make some references to the movies and things like that. So it's great.
That's good.
Tie it in.
I was watching Toy Story 3 over Christmas. And at one point, one of the cars that I think Bonnie's mum drives in the film, the number plate is MCU. So I say we start a rumour that Toy Story takes place in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Why not?
Let's do it.
So Disney.
It's both owned by Disney.
Yeah.
It could happen.
Yeah.
It probably won't.
It's not as batshit insane, frankly, as that all the Pixar movies are taking place in one universe theory as well. So yeah, I think so. What if Galactus arrived and tried to eat Pizza Planet?
I think Buzz Lightyear would save us.
I think he'd lose that fight, to be honest. I think
Pizza
pretty...
Planet does sound delicious. Like, that should be top of Galaxar's menu.
Galaxar? Who's Galaxar?
What? That is from something I was watching over Christmas. What is it? That was Monsters vs. Aliens, which I also watched over Christmas. I had a really highbrow viewing selection.
I saw Frozen for the first time over Christmas.
Oh my goodness!
Well, you know, I didn't mind it. I thought it was actually okay, but it's got my wife. It's got her in its icy thrall, and so she's now singing "Let It Go" all the time, and you know, she's making ice palaces and snowmen.
Has it sort of become the the Disney equivalent of the Thing, which like it's set in a frozen place and it takes people over, yeah. And they just become different, except they just sing show tunes and you know want to build snowmen all the time.
But the geekiest thing I got over Christmas—that's what the question was. Geekiest thing I got over Christmas. I probably have it with me. It's behind me right now because it's pissing down outside, is my Yoda lightsaber umbrella. The official Star Wars lightsaber umbrella, which I've wanted for years, and finally my sister got me one.
I did notice you were carrying that, and it is a thing of beauty.
It doesn't light up.
Oh.
It doesn't make a noise when you open it. But I've come to terms with that because I think if you did, and if it did, and if you walked down the street with a glowing green stick in your hands, it might draw attention to yourself more than you might want.
People might think you've just stepped out of Blade Runner, for example.
They might. Or they might try and attack you and take the umbrella.
True.
But it's great because they no longer sell those. So I think my sister actually took some time to track it down, which is unlike her. So thank you. Thanks, Sis, if you're listening to this. If, as ever, you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, you want us to consider your questions, and do send them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can Facebook us where we're Empire Magazine, or you can even email us if you have that technology. You can email us at podcast@empireonline.com. All very good. Time now for first guests of the new year. Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones are two of our finest young actors, and they're both set to garner lots of Oscar buzz for their portrayals of Stephen Hawking and his wife Jane in James Marsh's The Theory of Everything. They spoke recently to Ali and Phil the Simlian.
We're joined today by Felicity Jones and Eddie Redmayne to talk about The Theory of Everything. I'd like to say, to begin, well done, you made me cry. I hope you're pleased with yourself.
Good. That's all we wanted.
You horrible people.
We have achieved.
You wanted one journalist from Empire to cry. Well, you've done very well.
How many times did you cry?
Well, I just noticed that I'd cried. I was at the end of the film and went, oh.
This is
what humans call sadness.
Shed a tear.
this is bad news. But no, it's a very affecting film. I was wondering from your perspective, was it difficult on set sometimes? Because this is not a traditional working title rom-com, is it?
Was it difficult?
Now we've forgotten. So we've forgotten all the struggles and the arguments. Now we just say, yes, every day was a joy.
It was pretty rigorous. I think it was...
We both just felt such responsibility because we were playing real people and you know they're going to see it eventually. So it's something you don't take on lightly. And we both just became really passionate about them and vehement about them. And it was tough, but tough in a good way that we do lots of takes, but we always, you know, probably drove James Marsh, the director, crazy. Cause we're like, just one more. You know, he's like, no, we've got to move on because the light's going. But, and it was always just very discursive and we just wanted it to be as good as possible. So it was a good working relationship.
I interviewed James earlier this year, and he said that you guys were very invested in the film in a way that I guess sometimes you rap and then you move on to the next thing, but he said you were constantly kind of involved and wanting to do sort of ADR if necessary and seeing the post-production process taking shape. Is that fair? Was this one a bit more than the normal kind of professional experience?
I think it was. I think it was, and because of that sense of responsibility. Because when we were prepping the film, you know, we met Stephen and Jane and Jonathan and the children, and they allowed us into their lives. And I'm one of those people, when I see a film, I totally believe that everything I see on screen is true. And so I feel
it
like
is.
There is a great power in film, and that did make us feel that there was a great responsibility. And I mean, for both of us as well, because we were playing these characters over a long period of time, and yet we weren't shooting chronologically, so we were jumping in and out. James allowed us and encouraged us to watch the dailies, to watch the rushes. And so it was also very rare for actors to see every little ounce of footage. And so then long into the edit process, James was so generous at showing us stuff, but then encouraging us to go, was there something I missed? Was there, you know, and that was particularly with both of us, the different stages, to remember that detail. It was a great privilege, I thought.
Absolutely. And it also helps seeing the rushes early on. We could see the detail with which Benoit Delhomme, who's the DOP, and James were shooting it. You know, there'd be moments where they'd just be on Eddie's foot, Stephen's foot, or Jane's hand, and we could see how detailed it was. It was microscopic detail the camera was picking up.
What was it like watching the dailies of your face slamming into the floor? Because I watched that, and when they put that in the trailer, because
it's the sound effect as well, which is
he falls,
so
listeners,
it hits you so hard, doesn't it?
It's a real thump.
Do you know what? I did an interview the other day with Jennifer Lawrence, and that was all she wanted to know. She was like, "How do you do that?" I was like, "Jennifer, don't you do like hardcore stunt movies?" She's like, "Yeah, but that was." I was like, "I loved it," and I was saying how the poor guy who was the stunt guy on Stephen Hawking biopic. It's not quite the Marvel film.
It was easy like, right here, guys.
This is the biggest day of
But that shoot. Was the biggest day. But it involved, I'll never forget, we were shooting it in John's, Cambridge, and I arrived thinking that, and he started tying my hands behind my back and putting out like crash mats, and then he would just let me go. And I was like, why? And that, because your instinct is to pull your hands out. And then
sounds
in the
like
end,
torture.
I was like, this is horrific. And there were just like tourists going past, taking photos of me. It looked like I was doing sort of some bondage scene. I was like, anyway, it's all very...
But how did you just fall onto a crash mat?
Well, you do it, but you did it...
And then
when,
did they
when
move
did
it,
it on,
in post?
No, when you did it in the wide, you could just fall yourself. And then when in close up, you only started from your knees because they were just...
Oh.
And then they did tie my hands. But then they also had a pavement made out of... They'd painted a bit of padding. Am I giving away the secrets?
Oh, now we're all going to look really closely and next see the padding.
You'll be telling me Jupiter Ascending isn't real next.
It's all real. And I was all entirely real. Method.
It's Bergman.
You had a stuntman, but you also had an on-set, or maybe off-set, but near-set mathematician. I guess
this
a
is
stunt
true.
Physicist.
A stunt physicist.
On call.
This
is staring at the blackboard with the formula, and you could just go, "Oh, that looks like there's a plus sign in the wrong place. Call up the guy." Is that how it was?
That looks like a fun day as well. No, stunt physicist came in. He was actually an amazing man, one of Stephen's old students who is now like a professor at Imperial in London. And I met stunt physicists before we started filming to try and educate someone who gave up science when they were like a child to educate me. And he, you know, he would start telling me about the intricacies of string theory, and I'd be going, "Imagine I'm 7. Like, go back to what an atom equals. Like, what is oxygen?" Oh shit! That's...
Physics for dummies.
Yeah,
please.
Genuinely. So he was very helpful.
This is another question that was asked to James. You know, if you're at a dinner party and someone sits next to you and they're like, "So kind of explain the theory of everything. Explain particle physics. Explain string theory." Can you do that now? Are you just like, can you explain Interstellar to people?
I clearly won't be able to explain Interstellar, so like it's fair. But no, I find what was hilarious with these, Felicity studied English, James studied English, I studied history of art, and there were like months before we started filming, we were in Copenhagen where James lives, like working on the script. And we'd all come in and we'd go, "So basically, okay, basically general relativity is..." And then the other person would go, no. "So basically, isn't it?" Like, and we just realised that.
There's these really embarrassing conversations of three art students trying to explain particle physics or black hole theory. It's actually really hard. Do you guys? Can you go?
I did history and he did English.
Exactly.
Right?
So this is hopeless.
Absolutely
this
no
is
idea.
Terrible.
No, if the apocalypse comes, we're all doomed.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest.
We'll
but
be
what I find also interesting is that those people that go, because this is very much a love story, but those people go, "I wish it was the science story." Like, so many people I've met come out of this going, "I didn't really get the..." sort of got the science, didn't really get the science. Everyone sort of wants it to be, if people want it to be more rigorous scientifically, I'm like, well, how much...
Just watch a documentary. Don't you want to see a film. You want to have, you know, you want to go on an emotional journey, don't you? I'd say.
I think so.
We're just defending our film.
Who do that? speaking of stuntmen, I hope it was Euphilus who was actually carrying Eddie.
Yeah, I had to start working out in the gym because he may look really light, but actually
taut muscle.
He's 10 ton hefter. it was there was a lot of heavy lifting in this film.
Seriously. Emotionally and physically.
Yeah. I realised actually being a carer, you do have to be incredibly physically strong. So I remember we did this scene where I just Jane, it was when they're packing the car and they're going on holiday, and Jane is she's getting the kids ready, getting them in the car, she's packing all the things in the boot, she's lifting Steve, and I did think, God, I've done one day of this and I'm absolutely exhausted. I don't know how she did it for 25 years.
I want to ask a completely random question. I mean, it feels like you guys are both on the cusp of, well, it's award season coming up. You're going to have a lot of awardsy type stuff, I'm sure, to experience. I want to take you right back to the beginning of your on-screen careers, because you both came, you know, you were at Oxford, Flistine, you were at Cambridge, obviously, Eddie, and then, you know, came through a stage background and did TV films. Has anyone asked you about The Treasure Seekers recently, in which you play opposite Keira Knightley?
Yeah, it was...
Tell me about The Treasure Seekers.
Yeah, it's a great TV film.
Because Keira Knightley plays a sort of a German princess, and you're a bit of a sort of scallywag.
Yeah, I actually saw, there was a photo of it, of a kind of a still from the film, and we both look exactly the same. Like, Keira's got this lovely long hair, and then I'm just this sort of scally in the back with this, this sort of weird bob. That was great fun. We spent most of that time, there was this amazing swing in a tree that we'd all, in between filming, run and go and play on. We were, I think I was 11 and Keira was 10.
Oh, mini Keira, mini Jones.
I know, early days.
It's on YouTube, you can totally check that
is
out.
Is it? I'm going to.
And your first, I mean, you worked with Toni Collette.
Yes,
you started with Toni Collette.
That was my first film.
What?
Yeah, and she was
starting high there.
And then Robert De Niro, and obviously sharing a lot of screen time with Matt Damon and Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, that
was nerve-wracking. How was that?
Terrifying, but you can see it in the film. You just see me looking perpetually terrified the whole way through the film. I'll never forget. I was so lucky. So it was my second job. I got cast a film that Robert De Niro was directing. And went to America, was staying in a hotel in New York, like blacked out car to set, arrive in set, a huge craft service. They take craft service really seriously in America compared to the British sets where you get a sort of piece of slightly shoddy ham. And a huge set's being built, paparazzi outside because Angelina Jolie and Matt Damon were playing my parents. And more importantly, I was playing their son. And I arrive on set, and then all those people are there, and then suddenly there's a camera on your face in close up, and it was like, and roll camera, and I just genuinely
really
felt, I don't think I've ever sweated so hard. And as I say, like the whole way through the film, you can just see me looking.
I can't imagine
trying not to get fired is basically all I'm doing.
Absolutely terrifying. And I can't imagine Robert De Niro is known for being a little sort of taciturn, should we say? Quite sure. I can't imagine he's going to come over and go, Eddie, I was, you almost nailed it, just one more time. I mean, what do you remember any of the direction? What sort of direction?
Well, you know, the amazing thing, the one thing I really did learn from him is he has this, particularly in an emotional scene, and it was the time of film, so it was really expensive, but he would keep the camera rolling. And as soon as you finish a scene, you would go back to the beginning of it and channel that emotion, like pummel that down and start the scene again and just do take after take after take. And specifically in Les Miserables, that technique was really helpful. But in this as well, we would do some of the emotional scenes, wouldn't we? We would just go straight back into it, try not to spend too much time talking and discussing. And
yeah, well, you just, it's about trying to lose your self-consciousness. And so I always find the first few takes, you're overthinking it. And it's when you've planned something at home and then you bring it to set and then it doesn't quite work. So it takes a bit of time just to relax into it. But that must be so expensive on film. Because the great thing about shooting on digital is it's so cheap. So you can do these long 20-minute takes. But that's amazing to be able to do it.
Can we ask about your next projects? Because you both have really interesting things coming up. Juan Antonio Bayona, who of course did The Impossible, is a really fascinating filmmaker. And you're working with Liam Neeson, who, I think I misread the synopsis, but he's playing some sort of tree.
He's a tree that turns into a monster. It's based on Patrick Ness's book. It's a young adult book, fantasy novel about a young boy who is becoming a man and dealing with his mother who's dying of cancer, and also there's a grandmother character in it played by Sigourney Weaver. But Biona is absolutely amazing, and he, so many of the things that we did in theory, he makes it so easy for you as an actor. He's just so, like, loads of takes, trying things out. He plays Nicki Minaj before you do a take, like anything to make you as relaxed.
That's
as
why
possible.
The Impossible was so good.
Yeah, exactly. But it's just been such a fantastic experience, and I'm halfway through it now. So, but it's a beautiful, beautiful story and a beautiful book.
And Eddie, you're back with Tom Hooper.
Yeah.
So I presume you've worked with him a bunch now. It's just all, you don't even talk to each other. It's all kind of just mind.
No, there's a lot of talk.
No, we're doing a film called The Danish Girl, which we're just in beginning of prep for, which is a true story about two artists in Copenhagen in the 1920s called Einar and Gerda Vener. And Einar became one of the first, if not the first, people to transition and became a woman, Lily Elber. And it's a sort of film about... it's a love story and about identity, and it's really interesting. It's a script that's been around for a wee while, and they've been trying to make it into a film with various different guises. I'm just beginning to immerse myself and educate myself in that world.
So they're quite similar in many ways, aren't they? Anyway, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How were they, Ali? Were you all good?
Lovely people.
Lovely people.
Find Eddie Redmayne very charming. He was really good on Graham Norton recently, where he was asked how his performance, well, his audition performance for Bilbo Baggins was. Go watch it, because he did it with a voice. Instead of doing his own voice, he was like, "Hello, I'm Bilbo Baggins." And he just burst into it. Anna Kendrick loves it.
Because he waited to get the part, to be fair.
Also, Martin Freeman had that one in the bag.
Yeah.
Like in a very big, very Baggins. Secure Baggins.
Yeah, marked property of Martin Freeman.
They moved the whole date of production because they wanted him.
Yeah.
Eddie, still come in. What, so I can humiliate myself? Yeah, yeah, come.
No, do that funny voice you were doing. Peter really wants to see it. Oh, yeah, no, you're definitely in with the shot getting the role.
Can you do that again so we can record it?
Peter Jackson has its ringtone now, so.
I still want to see Vin Diesel's Aragorn audition. I genuinely want to see that. And Kylie Minogue auditioned as well
for Aragorn.
For Aragorn.
I would watch that. Oh, yeah.
No, she auditioned for Boromir. She sings to the arrows I can't get you out of my chest. No, she auditioned for Liv Tyler's character, Arwen. Should we talk about some movie news? Has there been anything happening over the last few weeks while we've been off?
There have been movie-wise. Some bits and pieces, yeah. One that caught my attention, which I thought was very exciting, as you know, the mantra around the Emperor office has been all Star Wars news is news. And our other mantra, of course, is that all Raid news is news. And so the two have come together in a beautiful melding with the news that Iko Uwais and his crew have apparently been doing some work on Star Wars : The Force Awakens.
His crew being Yayan Ruyan. Who played Precoso in Raid 2, and Mad Dog in the first Raid.
Indeed.
And Chechup Arif Rahman, who plays the assassin in the Raid 2 and is an English teacher by trade.
Really?
Yes.
You would not want to be late with your homework for that
not
man.
Not kidding. Iko, of course, being a phone salesman by trade. So these guys are... And you know the guy in the first Raid, the guy with the machete who has that massive fight with him at the with Rama?
Yeah.
And that, you know, he's just serious, hardcore, intense guy with the mad killer stare. Architect.
Well, you don't want to mess with an architect,
yeah,
do you? I've seen The Matrix.
Yeah, but this one doesn't bore the pants off you. He just slashes at you with a machete. But yeah, so is this confirmed? Are they definitely doing stuff?
It was originally reported by Twitch and then confirmed apparently by The Hollywood Reporter. So it seems to have some substance to it. There's no details on what the heck they're doing. Whether they're playing characters or doing some kind of performance capture or whether they're, you know, providing some kind of stunt choreography. I mean, we thought that, you know, production had wrapped, so it's kind of hard to know exactly what they would be doing if they were new characters. For me, performance capture maybe seems slightly more likely, making something move in a really cool fashion. But, you know, this is got to be good news for any fight scenes in the new Star Wars, I would have thought.
This is encouraging for me because it implies that they're using the Star Wars kudos to actually really take great talent, which may not be that well known, yeah, and do something with it. Star Wars has that power. It doesn't need to get, insert huge name here, you know. There was a part of me, a lot of people online are going, Benedict Cumberbatch is in everything right now. Helen sent me a funny cartoon where on someone's, is it radioscopy? Is that?
Ultrasound.
Ultrasound, that's the one. Slightly different. Benedict Cumberbatch's face crops up inside someone's womb and the pregnant lady says he really does get everywhere. But when that was announced as he might be part of it, I really hope not, because they can have anyone. Like, they could go up to pretty much anyone. And this is just really encouraging that they're going for the great talent. Because as much as we love The Raid, there are plenty of people who have no idea what that is. Mm. And this might be their first taste of Eco.
I'd be interested to see if they are playing characters or whether they've just been hired as a fight team. Because all the fights in The Raid and The Raid 2 were choreographed by Yayan and Eco. Chechep was brought in specifically for The Raid 2 to play that character. But he certainly, he knows his stuff as well. I mean, he can... Boy, serious guy. Love the guy, but serious. But yeah, so I'd be really interested to see whether they're there to inject a little bit of oomph to the fight scenes, or whether they might be like Ray Park with Darth Maul, actually presenting themselves as formidable foes, maybe, or Jedi of some kind, you know, leaping around and doing whatever they can do. Very exciting.
Very cool, yeah.
Cool.
Turning to the world of Marvel, which, as you know, we never talk about on this podcast. I mean... basically ignore it all the time. They've sort of come roaring out of the Christmas holiday with some Ant-Man promo work. There is both the poster, which is pretty hilarious. It's a teeny, teeny, tiny Ant-Man, a teeny, tiny Paul Rudd in the middle of a big white sort of space with the title of the film as well, which I think is very clever. Very good idea. Just different. It could have been a bunch of floating heads, or it could have been a big explosion with sort of Paul Rudd's face in front of it or something. And it's good. And the other thing that's come out is the first teaser trailer, which, of course, is always a little bit early. You know, there's not a lot of the effects work done, so they've had to rely more on sort of Michael Douglas doing voiceover and a couple of gags from Paul Rudd. And it's a teaser trailer. I mean, it teases some of the stuff that's happening. We see a little bit of shrinking. We see a little bit of some of the other characters, and it does the job.
I suppose the biggest problem it's got is how does it, in just a couple of minutes or a minute and a half in this instance, put across the very fine balancing act it's going to have to pull off, both for the comedy and for the action and for the inherent preposterousness of the conceit. This man has the ability through a suit to shrink down to a very, very small size. He can also control ants and fly on them and has super strength. So, yes, when you say it out loud, it sounds a bit silly, but it looks promising. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, I love the poster. The poster's fantastic. This is exactly the route they should have gone down. The trailer for me is fine, but it seems a little generic to me. Mm. It's kind of interesting to me that after Guardians of the Galaxy, which came straight out and basically went, we're different and weird and quirky, you know, with that poster tagline, you're welcome, and, you know, with... Yeah. Right from the off, the trailers were like, this is going to make you laugh.
They were memorable as well.
Yeah.
They really stuck in your head. The Ooga Chaka song stuck in your head.
Yeah.
It was perfect, pretty much.
This feels... There's a couple of things about the Ant-Man trailer. One is haunted, obviously, by the ghost of Edgar Wright. You just cannot help but watch this and start thinking what this would have looked like had Edgar directed the film. And also, you can't... You look at it and you think, hang on, tonally, this is, as Ali says, a slightly preposterous, slightly preposterous character. It's going to be comedic in tone, we're guessing, but it's a very serious trailer right up until the end when Paul Rudd kind of goes, is it too late to change the name? And that balance of tone is going to be very interesting to see how they handle it over the next few months.
Presumably the next thing we see from it is going to be much more emphasizing the funniness.
Yeah.
There was also some much sadder news over Christmas, which were there are a couple of obituaries that we should touch upon. First up for me is Edward Herrmann, who I know best probably these days as the family patriarch in the Gilmore Girls. But I first remember him being brilliant in The Lost Boys, as Goldie Hawn's appalling husband in Overboard. And he has an incredible career. He worked with Woody Allen, Oliver Stone, the Coens, Martin Scorsese. He was a bit of a sort of giant in TV and on screen, generally is more of a character actor than a sort of a leading man. He'd apparently endured months of treatment for brain cancer, but passed away peacefully with his family. So, tributes to him.
Absolutely. I will always remember him for Maximum Lost Boys. Talk about Billy Whitelaw as well, the great Billy Whitelaw. There's a wonderful piece written by Edgar Wright, who directed her in her last film, Hot Fuzz, on his website. So you go want to go and check that one out. It's really, really lovely. Talking about how he persuaded her to be in the film and how she knew it was going to be her last film, even though she was making it. Fantastic actress. So many great film and TV credits under her belt over the years. For me, though, she will always be Mrs. Baylock from The Omen.
Yeah.
Utterly terrifying, one of the great screen villains of all time, and from one of my favourite films of all time. So she will be missed, Billy Whitelaw.
Beep, 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 beep. That's the breaking news noise. It is Friday morning, the day after we record the podcast, usually. The BAFTA nominations are out. I've taken myself up to the pod booth with Phil Dissemblian. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Chris.
Not on the podcast this week, but no. You've come in especially for this.
Guest star,
Phil Dissemblian. We're going to very, very quickly talk about the BAFTA nominations, the best film list. It was Birdman, Boyhood, The Theory of Everything, The Grand Budapest Hotel, which got 11 nominations leading the way, and The Imitation Game. Interesting list, safe list, solid list. What do you think of it?
I think it's a pretty solid list on the whole, with one glaring omission, which is, of course, Mike Leigh's Mr. Turner.
Oh, a lot of people up in arms about that.
What's going on?
Yeah.
What is going on? That was in my very much close to the top of my top 10 for last year, and I think in common with a lot of people. I don't know whether it was just a film that critics loved and audiences were a bit...
It's made 6 million so far. It's Mike Leigh's biggest movie. Mm. So audiences clearly have seen it and liked it enough to keep going back and back and back. So it seems a bit strange to me to that one. I kind of wonder if Timothy Spall's omission in the Best Actor race may have been coloured by the fact that a lot of people then kind of summed up his performance as just a series of grunts, which it absolutely is not, of course. But it was very, very easy to shorthand his performance, I think, and go, he just turned up and went, blah, 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 blah.
Gosh.
Which
I have heard that a few times, but it seems egregious.
It does seem egregious, but that's the thing about these Oscar and BAFTA campaigns, that they can be derailed by the smallest thing. It's so weird. And I do wonder whether that had some effect on some people. It seemed to be so prevalent. I saw a lot of things on Twitter about how it was just Mr. Grunter and all that sort of stuff, and it just seems bizarre to me. But the biggest omission for me in terms of the acting categories, I mean, it's great to see Ralph Fiennes in there for Grand Budapest Hotel. He's phenomenal in that film. It's great to see a comedic turn being given his due. And Jake Gyllenhaal for Nightcrawler as well. Great. But where's David Oyelowo for Selma? Now, this is obviously an anecdotal thing. This is not indicative of wider feeling within BAFTA. But for example, I went to a BAFTA screening of Selma a few weeks ago, followed by a Q&A with David Oyelowo. And as he came out on the stage, the entire auditorium rose to give him a standing ovation. I have never seen this before at a Q&A for anything, whether it's BAFTA, Oscar, it doesn't matter. I've never seen the audience give an actor a standing ovation before. He's phenomenal in that film. And so it just makes you wonder, what happened?
It is a strange one. Very strange.
The film itself is fine. It's good. It's a powerful movie, slightly rudimentary, but...
Well, he could win.
He's amazing.
He could win Best Actor at the Oscars and not get a BAFTA nomination be a British actor. And what's going on with that? It's hard to say. I've seen the film, and you're right. He's absolutely stupendous in it. Mm. So, don't know. Strange.
Strange one.
Strange one. Very strange.
That film got omitted completely. The likes of Foxcatcher didn't really get any traction in terms of Best Film. Steve Carell, interestingly, and both he and Mark Ruffalo are in Best Supporting, which is interesting. I imagine that's a decision that's been made specifically to put them in that category.
Yes. Slightly strange. They see Channing Tatum as the lead, but really it's got three leads or three support.
On the poster alone, it says Steve Carell. His name is first. Steve Carell, Channing Tatum, Mark Ruffalo. So,
There's always a bit of sleight of hand, isn't there, with, you know, who's support and who's top liner. Laura Dern in Wild would have been nice to see some love for her. Yeah. She's really good in that film, but no.
What's the thing you're most pleased about?
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah.
Ralph Fiennes.
Phenomenal.
So good. I love the film. I love him in it. What he does is so difficult, and he does it so well. I would love to see him win, but we shall see.
You can quibble about this endlessly until the end of days. The thing I'm most pleased about, however, great to see Paddington in Outstanding British Film. Well done, Paddington. The likes of 71 are in there as well. Slightly disappointed that Calvary didn't get too much love. I think that film's fantastic as well. And the bigger omissions for me are a yellow one Spall in actor. But otherwise, you know, it's a fairly... decent list, solid list, some great films in there, some films in there that maybe you could argue don't deserve to be there over films like Whiplash and Nightcrawler, but it's a fine list.
And we'll obviously have a special podcast to discuss the best foreign language films.
We will, yeah. We will. Terrific. I have to run, so...
another time.
Another time. Is that the time?
You promise.
I really got to go.
Later. I'll see you later.
See you later.
Okay.
I'll see you later.
Come back here later.
Okay, I'm going to do the breaking news outro music. If you just bear with me 2 seconds, I've just got to get into character. Beep, 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 beep. And now we return you to your regularly scheduled podcast.
Yeah, but there's also some other movie news that happened this week, which is really interesting. So Daredevil, Netflix have announced that Daredevil will hit Netflix in April. That's the 13-part first of their Marvel TV series. And all 13 parts will hit at once.
They will.
Which is interesting. I thought they would go down the weekly little feeding. I'll feed you.
That's not what Netflix does.
No, it isn't. It isn't. It's going to be interesting to see. I'll have to watch all 13 in a go.
Just book.
Don't like binge watching. Don't like it.
Then don't. You have that freedom, Chris. The freedom is yours.
I have to, because then other people will see it. Oh, Netflix. Netflix. Thank you.
Just think of the injustice that we live in a world where other people have seen Agent Carter and I have not. I mean, you just have to learn to deal with these things.
Well, I can tell you that in the first episode... Sorry. I won't go on about it.
All right. Have you seen it?
I have.
Oh. Yes. Good.
It's good fun. It's a great sort of throwback, sort of retro spy thriller. Hayley Atwell is, as ever, fantastic as Carter. It's practically the role she was born to play. Not that she can't play any role, because she is brilliant. And it's really, really good. If you really enjoyed the one shot, it very much captures that spirit, but just expands the world, gives her a fantastic sort of relationship with Howard Stark, gives her a fantastic sort of, not relationship, just sort of back and forth, witty banter friendship, and also with James Darcy as Edwin Jarvis, who is the perfect snidely sort of Jeevesy type butler, that's sort of, slightly aloof and slightly, but is also kick-ass, and it's really good. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's made me feel so much better. Ali, didn't you have other news?
Ghost in the Shell is a very, 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 very highly respected... Well, the jury's out really on how you want to call this, but it was originally a manga, it was originally a comic in Japan, and then it was turned into an anime feature film. And it is so revered and loved and cherished and cuddled. It's about a bionic policewoman in the future. Put it this way, in quality Japanese tagline work, the tagline for the film is, "People love machines in 2029 AD, open quotes. Who are you? Who slips into my robot body and whispers to my ghost?" Oh, Japan. It's the story of a kind of a Matrix-like. The Wachowskis were really, really into this, and a variety of other films like it. In fact, you may even notice, if you rewatch this film, The Ghost in the Shell, you may notice quite a few direct lifts, like action beat lifts from this in the Matrix movies, I should say. Anyway, the big news is that the long-mooted Hollywood remake is happening. And they have their star, and it is Scarlett Johansson, who's playing what seems like a similar role to Lucy, which made big bucks in the box office last year, and I thought was a bag of pants. But it's done well. People have obviously liked it, who weren't me. And she's suiting up for it. She'll play this bionic cop with a name that's almost impossible to not get entirely wrong. Motoko Kusanagi, a cyborg cop, and part of Section 9, who go around trying to find the puppet master, who is this hacker extraordinaire in the, surprisingly, the future now. I mean, it used to be back when I watched it quite a long way away, but now it's actually just around the corner. Shit.
Yeah, Rupert Sanders is directing it. He's obviously the man that did Snow White and Huntsman, and he's been attached for a little while. And it's going forward now. For a little while there, it looked like Margot Robbie might be doing it, but she, of course, is now doing Suicide Squad for Warner's and DC. So here we have Scarlett.
This is an interesting one. I actually sat down and watched this last night because the last time I saw it was sometime in the 90s and I didn't really remember it. And I was amazed by, I think the big problem, the big challenge I think with this film is that lots of films have lifted ideas from it since and you've got to work around those. But it still has its own sort of style and its own kind of edge. I mean, that music especially, if they can get that kind of creepy,
it's very
gorgeous...
creepy film.
Music, then I think we might be onto something and get the tone to match that. I think we'd be really onto something. A slight concern is that, Johansson's done things awfully like this before, not just you know, the kick-ass stuff that she's done in Avengers and in Lucy, but also the slightly more esoteric side of things. She's also kind of done in like Her and Under the Skin even to a very tiny extent. So it feels like maybe it's too nailed on, but on the other hand, maybe that means that she's the perfect person to tackle it because she's obviously interested in all this stuff. Mm. I do think that you could make it make a little bit more sense without, you know...
That's fair.
Losing too much.
The movie's very confusing.
Yeah.
The original movie is very confusing, and not just because of subtitles. And you'll notice it kind of flashes up on screen and go, wait, what? And you have to rewind in the middle of an action sequence. Wait, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Who's in whose body is often a question I was asking myself. Where's the mind? Ah.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, if you're in this robot body, you tend to have superpowers, I should point out. You are super strong and such. So that'll be fun.
Yeah, I'd be interested if they do that bit at the end with the sort of the hulking out scene, because that seems like something that Hollywood would usually avoid. If you've seen it, you'll know what I mean. If you haven't, I don't want to say any more in case I ruin it. But yeah, a good movie though. Ghost in the Shell. Go see it.
I saw someone on Twitter say that the major worry, the major concern for them with this movie was that it's produced by Avi Arad, who's been attached to the project for a long, long time. Avi Arad, of course, is the former head of Marvel. He was the guy who set the ball rolling, I guess, for that eventually became Marvel Studios when Kevin Feige took over. He then subsequently went on to produce the Ghost Rider movies and the Spider-Man movies, to which he's still attached. But I don't know. I think Avi Arad's a massive fan of manga and anime. He's even written a manga called The Innocent, which wasn't bad, as far as my understanding of these things go. So I think he treats this with reverence and... I think it'll be okay. We shall see.
As I mentioned earlier on, this Empire podcast is brought to you in association with Squarespace. Here is Ali to explain the science bit.
Hello and welcome to the science bit of the Empire podcast, where Ali the editor, that's me, tells you a bit more about our sponsor Squarespace and how to make use of their free trial and discount deal. If you're not already in the know or missed Chris saying it earlier, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use our offer code EMPIRE. That's one word, EMPIRE. Here are a few more reasons why you might want to use Squarespace. For starters, Squarespace is very easy to use, as well as being user-friendly and doing all the tricky stuff for you. That's search engine optimization, hosting and making your site mobile, tablet, portable device friendly, for starters. They've also got a huge vault of pre-prepared designs and style options for you to be getting on with and then tweak to your taste. If you sign up for a year, you get a free domain name and you'll enjoy an on-hand support team working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All for $8 a month. You'd have to change that into pounds, obviously, if you're from Britain. With, as mentioned earlier, a free trial and 10% off your first purchase with the Empire Podcast's very own offer code, EMPIRE, via squarespace.com. Thank you for listening. Here is the rest of the show, which will seamlessly start again now.
Also, I'm very intrigued this week. There's a couple of other little teeny little tidbits I want to talk about. Born 5 has a new release date. It's going to be out in July 29th, 2016. But more interestingly, the screenplay for it will be written not by Tony Gilroy, but by Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon themselves, which is very, very interesting, along with Greengrass's longtime editor, Christopher Rouse.
Hmm.
Apparently, they all came up with the idea for the new Born movie. So that's very, very interesting. And I think if you're worried about quality control... I think we're okay.
That would seem to put some quality issues at rest.
I think we're okay. And then because I'm a big fan of neat segues, Michael Keaton is in talks to star alongside Tom Hiddleston and J.K. Simmons in Skull Island. Kong: Skull Island, which is coming out, I think, now in 2017. Is that right? It's coming out in 2017?
I believe so, yes.
It got pushed back. So that's very interesting. Why am I saying that in the interests of segue? Well, it just so happens. Because, wouldn't you believe it, Michael Keaton is our second guest this week. He is, of course, a movie star who mounted a comeback after playing a superhero in Tim Burton's Batman movies, which presumably gave him unique insight into his new role in Alejandro G. Iñárritu's Birdman, in which Mr. Keaton plays a movie star mounting a comeback after playing a superhero. Interesting. He spoke to Ali and Phil once again when he came to London recently. Enjoy.
We are sitting in a room with Michael Keaton in honour of Birdman, which is a movie that we as a magazine, Empire Magazine, have given 5 whole British stars to.
Holy moly.
I want to ask you about the voice, not only of your character, but of your character's character,
yeah.
Birdman.
Yeah.
How did you do that gravelly, bald
Bale's voice.
When we were making Batman, I'm annoyingly logical. And even though it is a superhero movie or whatever you want to call them, I don't really know what you want to call them, it's a based on a comic book character, you know, and you're allowed to kind of fool with reality somewhat or logic somewhat. I said to Tim, I said, look, you know, we were rehearsing a scene or getting or staging a scene, you know, setting up, blocking the scene, and I'm standing on the street and I'm fairly exposed, not as Bruce Wayne, but as Batman, and there's this conversation slash kind of confrontational scene. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I said, you know, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. I said, why would they not? I've had this conversation from me to you, and why would somebody say, hey, everybody, look, it's Bruce Wayne. We just figured out who Batman is. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, I can't do this. I don't know how to play this. And I get that it's, you know, I get the what we're really making, but I just don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do things like that. I mean, even when I did the other guys, Adam McKay and Chris Henchy will tell you, I said, I don't want to make a big deal of this, but I need to ask you certain questions about this guy. I know what we're doing. It's ridiculously silly and fun. Yeah. I don't know where to start unless I have certain answers. I just don't know how to do it. It's not like I'm so cool. I just don't literally know how to do it. Yeah.
Can I just leap in quickly?
Sure.
The TLC lyrics. Was it
so great?
Did people come out to the street and go, don't go chasing waterfalls?
Yes, that's one of my favorite things they do. I mean, people come up and quote my lines from movies. I have 90% of the time, I have no idea what they're talking about. But this time, every time they do that, it makes me laugh. Anyway, so real quickly, we're having this... So I say to him, so we gotta make an adjustment. First of all, I gotta play this on an angle. We gotta drop me into the kind of in the shadows of blah blah blah. And Tim, that Tim probably thought of that actually. He probably said, okay, here's how we'll fix some of that. But here's what I said. I said I had a whole thing I did. You know, once he starts to go into Batman mode, out of Bruce Wayne mode, I can't remember. I was talking about this the other day. I think I wore contacts. Real subtly changed my eyes, I think. I can't remember. I did that for another movie, maybe. So anyway, I said, he goes into a kind of different state. And I said, and what happens is, the register of his voice changes. I'm just saying, well, here's what I'm going to do. And so, we're getting ready to shoot the first scene where I come on. He says, also, he said, I think the line was, what are you, originally? And I said, I think you should say, who are you, I think. Something like that, to set up, I'm Batman, right? So I drop in register and I kind of come up with this voice just to alter it and to be, you know, make it arguably kind of fun and like, you know, like cool sounding, but not really think about that so much, just playing the reality of, I can't sound like Bruce Wayne, everybody, I'm busted. So I tell Alejandro the story and then I go, and so we're doing, I just do this thing where I go, I'm Batman. And he goes fucking crazy. And I goes, he goes, Chivo. Emmanuel Lubezki, DP, says, come here, listen to this. And so he goes, do that thing. And so I do it, and he goes, that, we have to do that when we do Birdman. And I go, all right. And we haven't shot any of the Birdman stuff yet, so I'm going, okay, whatever, I'm not going to really think about it. Then as we start to do it, because we did that in post, but then we start to do this voice, and I start to work from that, and he pushes and pushes, no, and he's rewriting constantly, and we're shooting those things over and over and over again and rewriting it, go back the next day and do it. And the voice kept evolving, so that's how the voice kind of came out of that, and then it just got to be really more and more and more, you know, because he just wanted more and more.
Was he doing take after take after take? Was it like, I know, I want smells
it was
like
day
balls.
After day. It was
18th time.
Yes, yes.
19th
yes,
time.
Yes, yes, wow. Yes.
I know it was a grueling shoot. It was quite a short shoot. And it's a technical filmmaking tour de force. It has that kind of feeling of a really grand cinematic experiment almost.
Yeah.
Like something out of Buñuel. And you've got Chivo Lubitsky who shot Gravity. And there's an element of the camera being, you know, these long tracking shots. Did it feel like that when you were filming? Did it feel different to the other films that you've worked on? Did it feel experimental?
Yes.
Or theatrical?
Yes. Yes and no, but mostly yes. Yeah, it felt like you just said, I was entering an experiment, which made it really exciting. And then you basically have to really just drop back into what you do anyway. But you had to be... I had to be, we had to be, I suppose. I don't really know. I haven't talked about this with the other actors. I don't want to be camera aware. When I show up, I I just want to be present in the scene, and cameras are where they are, and I'm not, not that I don't sometimes check the size of the lens just to know some things, but I almost never do even that anymore. I just shoot me like you, like there's no camera here in the room. So that's my goal every time, and I try to get better and better and better and better and refine it the more I do this for a living. That said, I had to do that and at the same time be quite camera aware in this case, because you had to help out. You had to make sure it's one camera. You had to make sure you were in frame at the correct time, and that the camera operator actually would be like running down the street getting set up to catch you, and then maybe Zach Galifianakis coming up behind me and then walking down a sidewalk. So you had to, we were all trying to make this together, so you had to be helpful to the camera operator and to Chivo, which was interesting.
Do you remember the day you were fitted for those pants for your Times Square moment? Did you have any say in the underwear?
As silly as that is, that's actually a really good question. I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know, I remember instinctively knowing that would look the silliest, and the black socks is a brilliant touch, just because it just gets more and more sad. I'm actually going to try and think about this, because I think sometimes when I read scripts, I thought everybody thought like this. I already see the picture. And so sometimes I'm surprised when I show up and I see the set and I go, what is this? And they go, what do you mean, what is this? Blah, 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 blah. And I go, oh, wow, that's wild. I never saw it like that. I always saw it like this. And so did, I don't think it was written. And so did Alejandro. There might have been discussion. Should he be wearing boxers? And I think immediately everybody went, no, that's not going to look nearly pathetic enough.
So you haven't had Calvin Klein on the phone for their next campaign. When you finished this film, did you want to go and do another movie straight away, or did you want to go and do something on stage?
I wanted to do nothing. I wanted to do nothing but sleep.
You have a big ranch in Wyoming, in Montana. Wyoming. Is it Wyoming or Montana?
Montana.
So did you just go back and just...
Yeah, almost just immediately. Yeah.
See the dogs and...
Yeah.
Recover.
Yep. Hang with the dogs and horses, and hang out with my pals and my friends, yeah, I did for as long as I could, and then I kind of stupidly took another movie, happens to be a good movie, and now I'm doing all the publicity for this after having just finished the movie, so looking forward to some nap time.
What's the good movie, I have to ask?
It's called Spotlight, Tom McCarthy directing, with, once again, another really, really good cast, Mark Ruffalo, who's here shooting something somewhere. I'm going to try and see him for dinner. And Rachel McAdams and John Slattery and Liev Schreiber and who else is it? I don't know, but it's a great cast. Yeah, it's a great.
And a good director as well, obviously.
Yeah.
And Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah.
Another Hulk.
Yeah, I know.
Two Hulks in a row, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you talk?
I know, two Hulks in a row, two
back. Double Hulkage. Did you talk to Ed Norton about his experience?
I want to put out on this is radio. He when he said double Hulkage, he put two thumbs up at the same time. So fucking pathetic. Double Hawkage, like this. It was so geeky. Sorry. Please, can we get a camera in here?
Super cool.
Yeah.
Ouch.
He didn't really, but that would have really been sad if he did.
Just socks and pants.
Yeah. Yeah. Two thumbs up. Winking, double Hawkage.
Weak. Birdman was in three Birdman movies. You were in two Batman movies. The third one, I gather.
Wait, true. Catch me up. Do that again.
There were three Birdman movies.
Yes.
He turned down number
right,
four.
That's right.
But you obviously turned down number three when it came to Batman. Is it true that you popped your head around and saw 10 minutes of the third one and thought you made the right call in not doing that?
I made the right call without ever having seen it. and then I did see a bit of it. I didn't see enough of it to know, you know, really, frankly.
Yeah.
I just looked at it and went. It, you know, I don't know, just wasn't an interesting direction to go, I don't think.
The character in this film, in Birdman, has a poster of Birdman. I think it's Birdman 3, in his, you know, dressing room. Do you have either a poster of Batman or Birdman, the actual film, in your ranch or at your house?
No, well, there haven't been any. Oh, wow, I didn't think of that. No, I got to get one of those. Wow, that just hit me. No, I do have some, have you seen the one sheets? Oh. They're cool, aren't they?
They're so cool.
I know. And there's one for every city, which I just saw Toronto when I was working in Toronto, and this one here is very cool.
Sydney's got the Opera House.
Really?
Yeah.
It's awesome. So I do somewhere, I think, have Batman. I think I've got a Batman poster somewhere.
I think there will be a new level of meta if in your office at home there is a poster of either Batman or Birdman.
Yeah, yeah. In there. Wow, you know what? That's a very cool idea. Yeah, I'm going to do that. All right. Thanks for reminding me.
My pleasure.
By the way, you did it without any thumbs up.
No thumbs up. That's my shtick.
Really?
Oh, it's
cool.
Embarrassing. It is a great poster, though. It's one of our favorites of the year and a really brilliantly marketed film as well. That takes you into it, into that world of Birdman, which is a world I think all of our listeners should go and experience firsthand. I just wondered, you know, it obviously touches on your relationship, or at least the character's relationship.
By the way, I had this suggestion. Alejandro and I have talked about actually doing a Birdman, but doing it exactly like the movie we kind of say he didn't, wasn't going to make anymore. Do, say, you know, actually make a Birdman movie like you would make, like a big studio would make, a kind of horrible super, and Jackson, make one like that. And like, this is the unexpected Birdman, the unexpected, or the unexpected virtue of ignorance. And I'd say this one should be Birdman. We were just fucking around the first time.
I would watch the hell out of that. Like, who would be his nemesis, though?
I don't know. We could create some, I don't know. That'd be, yeah, then you could create a whole slew of evil villains.
Yeah. I think they made that, but didn't they? Condor Man.
Is there Condor Man?
Condor Man. Yeah, really? With Michael Crawford.
Is that true?
Yeah.
It's superbly bad.
It's really,
really
bad. It's really bad.
You'd love it. I mean, in terms of this. I'm going to interrupt the third interruption here, but in your mind, what is the backstory to Birdman? Is there an alter ego to Birdman? Does he, what does he do?
I'm going to sound like I'm inefficient. I created a backstory for Riggan.
Right.
I didn't think of a backstory, but boy, that would be fun to think about, of what the story, what those probably were about. You know, he laid that on me, thinking back. Alejandro kind of said, because we talked about it for a minute, he said he just kind of had this image in his head. And when he was a kid, he said he read something where there was a kind of character in Mexico that reminded him of this. And he just came up with the idea of that kind of imagery, you know. I don't know, other superheroes are, how many superheroes are there that are based on non-human things?
Spider-Man.
Hulk is what? Just a thing.
Gamma radiation.
Yeah, that's not an animal.
No, there's no.
Spider-Man. Batman.
Condor Man.
Jeez, he just did the two thumbs thing again.
Jesus. Anyway, I interrupted you, Phil. What were you saying?
I was just going to ask about something. You've been in some of the most beloved roles of the last sort of 20 or so years. Obviously, Beetlejuice is one.
Yeah,
and we talked when you came to promote your directorial debut. I'm assuming it's a debut, and there'll be others.
Debut, yeah, want to, yeah.
Merry Gentlemen, and you were enthusing about that, and there's been constant rumor on the internet about a Beetlejuice, another Beetlejuice movie, another Beetlejuice. When was the last time you saw Tim Burton, and what's the latest on that?
Oh boy, the latest is this conversation keeps coming up, and it's now reached a point where I don't know. I have no idea at this point. There was a back and forth, I don't know, 6 months ago between Tim and myself and Graham, guy Tim, I think wants to write it. And I would say that at this point, I'm so kind of, I don't think about it much anymore, which is too bad, because I, when I finished it, I said, oh man, this is the one thing I'd do again, like probably a month later. That's probably not true, like 6 months later or a year later, but I really don't know, but it's so original, and I'm not sure. I think Tim is starting another movie now, or in the middle of another movie now.
He's just finished Big Eyes.
Which it looks so cool. Obviously, you know, you need him around in some capacity. But you know, he's so original. You know, he's such an artist. And then you know, you get to be with another one like Alejandro. You know, and you know, I was thinking about this the other day. I've done movies where I am the title, you know what I mean, and I thought, wait a minute, does this happen a lot? Like, I did a movie called Mr. Mom. It's a name, Mr. Mom. I am Mr. Mom. Batman is a name. You know what I mean? Birdman is a name. Wait, there's another. Beetlejuice, obviously. In other words, the title of the movie is me. Wait, there's another one.
There should be one called Ray Nicolette. That's all I can say.
Ray Nicolette was called Johnny Dangerously. Mr. Mom, right. There was another one I thought of the other day, like some one of the smaller ones. That's kind of wild when you think about it. I don't know what. That's pretty cool, though. Ray Nicolette was a weird, cool character.
We're big fans.
I think we have to wrap up shortly, but last question.
Okay.
Toy Story 4 has been announced.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
Because we're kind of hoping that Ken's going to be back.
I know. That would be cool. When I was on the phone, I was in my kitchen. I get this call. It said, these guys from Pixar want to talk to you. I said, oh, cool. You know, those guys are really talented. And they say, hi, blah, blah, blah. They talk about four sentences. And said, when they said we were thinking of you, the phone literally fell out of my hand laughing down on the floor. And I don't know why. I don't even know why. I didn't go, oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, let's talk. The notion that there would be a Ken just made me fucking laugh. I don't know why. It just made me laugh.
Us too.
I'm keen for a Ken spinoff movie. I think that would work well.
Yes, good idea.
Ken the movie. Yeah. Anyway, it's been a great pleasure.
All right, thanks, fellas.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys. See you later.
How was he? Livewire? Funny? Michael Keaton-y?
He was great. He was great. There's a bit which is slightly embarrassing, but as you heard in the interview, he got the idea that Phil was a massive, massive comic book nerd for some reason, and with a double thumbs up thing, right? So you'll all have heard that, but he was like, you probably want a photo with a double thumbs up, right? Ha 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 ha. And Phil said, yeah, right? Understandably, as you would. And so he does a double thumbs up, and you think, this is going to be the best photograph ever. It's Michael Keaton next to Phil, double thumbs up, double thumbs up. The guy taking the photograph basically took a photograph of the wall. There's like a blurry blob.
Oh. Who was the guy?
His assistant or someone's assistant. It was very quick. I mean, there was no time to press the button on the iPhone that makes it focus. Well, I say button, the bit on the screen. Looking at the image is almost more memorable. Oh, look at that blob. Oh, do you remember that fuzzy bit? Oh, yeah. Oh, Michael Keaton.
Do you have it on your phone or is it just
on Phil's? Oh, it's on Phil's phone.
Unbelievable. Let's start our extended review section with a quick look back at Birdman and The Theory of Everything, both of which opened in the UK on Jan 1st. Birdman in London, slightly before that, of course, in selected cinemas. So, just very, very quickly, because most people will have already seen them, Birdman.
Mm.
We gave it 5 stars.
That is about right for me. I thought it was absolutely wonderful. At the risk of sounding like a jazz fan, which I'm not, it felt like jazz in the sense that it just had that freewheeling kind of side to it. It didn't really stop. There were no breaks. You didn't really step out of it at any point and catch your breath. There wasn't a scene change that kind of jarred you out of whatever mood you were in. And that actually, you know, was really, I don't want to say powerful, that sounds too kind of pretentious, but it was really involving and it really got you into the headspace of the characters. And I loved that. I thought that was great. So you just kind of sit back and let it sweep over you and it kind of takes you away with it, which I thought was wonderful. Great, great performances. I mean, I don't really have to say that. Everyone has been saying that. But really just beautifully put together as well. Just the sheer kind of flow of it, I thought, was absolutely out of this world.
I should just remind everybody, I know you've heard this in the previous podcast, and obviously you've heard the interview as well, but this is about, Michael Keaton's character is putting on a play in Broadway. He's taken all of his money, and he's put it into taking quite a pretentious novel and turning it into a pretentious play, because he wants to prove to everyone that he is an artist, which is totally understandable. And it's done with an all-star cast, with Zach Galifianakis and Edward Norton and all mod cons. Emma Stone plays his daughter, who is a bit messed up, as is everyone in this movie. And it's kind of been talked about a lot because it does a rope-style trick, as in Hitchcock's rope, of making shots semi-seamlessly, I should say, connect to each other. And it feels like a very fluid, individual take, although it does do tricks like pushes the camera up to the sun, then the sun goes down, and then it comes back up, and you see that sort of thing. You know, the back of a door or back of someone's shirt is the traditional trick, back of someone's jacket. So it's really a flair piece from Inarritu, trying to almost show what he can do and discuss what it is to make art and be an artist and suffer the slings and arrows of critics.
And this is another Lebesgue cinematography job, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
As in Chivo, who did Gravity last year.
Emmanuel Lebesgue.
Yeah. So that's a bit of a recommendation as well. Frankly, at this point, I'd go see anything he does.
Blimey.
Yep, I said it.
If he could make the Police Academy remake, you'd see it.
I would see that anyway.
Yeah, I agree.
Actually.
I don't know why that one left in mind. Five stars then for Birdman. And let's move on then very, very quickly to the four star, The Theory of Everything, the tale of young Stephen Hawking and his wife, Jane.
This is a lovely little movie. It really does sort of swing around the two main performances of Redmayne and Jones as this couple. It charts the sort of time in Stephen Hawking's life you may not be that familiar with unless you've really read up on his life, his younger years, his student days before he sort of succumbed to his motor neurone disease and was in a wheelchair and that sort of thing. It sort of introduces you to the love affair between Stephen and Jane and how they came from very sort of opposing viewpoints. He's very science and sort of mathematics, and she's very much more sort of religion and poetry and literature, and how they managed to blend into this fantastic couple that for at least a good sort of 30 years or so of their lives was sort of a wonderful marriage and supporting each other and working out. And also then, of course, goes into how even in his younger days, he was essentially given what everyone said was almost a two-year death sentence. Everyone said, you'll probably be dead in 2 years from this motor neurone disease. And as we all know from the real world, he's lived many years longer than that. And it's a really lovely look at their relationship, the ups and the downs and the problems and his entire life. It's slightly biopic in that it does sort of follow his life, you know, A to B to C to D, this is what happens. But it's lovely, it's lovingly shot. I mean, James Marsh, the director, has done a really sort of nice job sort of getting everything where, and he does manage to explore how Hawking comes up with some of his ideas. He sort of has there's a moment where he's looking at a fire and he suddenly starts seeing things exploding in the fire, and he sort of comes up with atomic ideas and things like that. So it's a really lovely made film.
And Eddie Redmayne is fantastic in it. Again, we're kind of beating the same drum here. This is the season to go see movies in the cinema. It is Oscar time, BAFTA time. Eddie Redmayne, fantastic work. We talk about how he falls over. It's in the trailer. There's a moment where the motor neurone disease kind of grabs him by the ankles and just kind of yanks him and reminds him that it's boss. And he slams into the floor. And that's the beginning of him kind of transforming into this. He physically embodies this person, Stephen Hawking, is a real transformation from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
He's never, you know, clicking his heels together at the beginning, but he really, by the end of it, when he's in the wheelchair and he's delivering speeches to adoring crowds, you believe it.
Yeah, it's astonishing. I mean, physically speaking, it's performance of the year. I think it's absolutely incredible. I would absolutely expect him to be on the nominees list. For me, he might take it, actually. I just think it's so technically difficult to do as well as, but I think he gets the twinkle in the eye as well. I think that's the thing, you know, throughout all of this, I think what's really impressive is watching two basically decent people trying to basically be decent to each other. Even when things get incredibly tough and they have to deal with things that no person should have to deal with, they're still trying their best. And I think that's kind of the inspirational angle here as much as the great work that he accomplishes. I think the interconnection between them is it almost as inspiring. I thought it was really, really good.
Mm. And to take nothing away from Felicity Jones, who doesn't have the sort of, you know, the grandstanding performance of being able to do this. She just embodies sort of Jane Wilde as Jane Hawking and is wonderful in it, because you see this person that commits herself to caring for this man that she loves and who just becomes her own independent person at the same time and has her own outside interests. And she's a wonderful singer. She joins choirs. She organizes things. And it's a fantastic little performance. It's really, really well done. They both have to deal with, you know, the moving of the years. They have to age the characters. And they both do it wonderfully.
And it is from her perspective, I should point out. If you're thinking this is a... and then he discovered this, and here's another scientific paper, and then he did this. Space. It's not that. It's a family affair. It's drama. Yeah. There's a very, very affecting moment. The final act, them talking, and the voice is on board. That's a real killer. But yeah, it's from her perspective, based on her memoirs. So if you're very interested, you've watched the film, do check them out.
Indeed, four stars then for The Theory of Everything. And as you mentioned, it is Oscar season. There's a lot of Oscar fare in the cinemas right now. And this week's releases starts off with Into the Woods, which is obviously based on the Stephen Sondheim musical. All-star cast, Meryl Streep, Johnny Depp, Emily Blunt, Chris Pine.
Yep.
Even our own James Corden is in there as well. fairy tale tinged.
Yes, oh, fairy tale throughout. This was kind of being talked up as an Oscar contender more before we saw it than afterwards, I think, just because, you know, Rob Marshall had made Chicago before and had Oscar success with that. But musicals aren't inherently Oscar-y in the same way, and especially this musical is so weird, frankly, that I think it's not the most obvious contender at the end of the day. But it has Meryl Streep in it, ergo we're having this conversation. She plays the witch, the Wicked Witch, who's kind of the engine of the story in some ways. In other ways, it's James Corden and Emily Blunt who play a baker and his wife, who are desperate to have a child. And it turns out they can't because James Corden's been cursed because of a family curse. His father was cursed by this witch because he stole greens from her garden. And the only way to break the curse is to assemble a variety of magical objects within 3 days, and that will solve the problem. So they head into the woods to try and find these objects, as do numerous other people who include basically Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, Rapunzel's up in there. There are princes rolling around, and everything seems on course. This seems like you know what's going to happen. This is a fairy tale. Everything's kind of going to work out. But it's also a Stephen Sondheim musical, which kind of deconstructs the whole idea of fairy tales and questions how they work. So the happy ending, this is not a major spoiler because the musical has been out there for 40 years. The happy ending comes about 2/3 of the way into the film, and then things go a bit wrong. And that's where it kind of gets interesting. So it's a little bit of a different take on the fairy tale mythos. It's often very funny, particularly where Chris Pine's Nitwit Prince is concerned. He gets, for me, the song of the film is Agony, and he gets that really, really well. Otherwise, it's probably the best film they could have made from Into the Woods, but whether they should have made a film of Into the Woods is another affair, because it doesn't naturally lend itself to being on screen. It actually works better if you have that interval after the happy ending and then go back in for lots more. Trying to play that through actually feels profoundly weird, and I had a little bit of a problem with that. So it's good, but it's not great.
It suffers from the same problem as Les Mis did, which is it is so intrinsically stagey. This is by Sondheim, who you could call the Shakespeare of musical writers. He is a very, very highly respected man, and he wrote a musical about musicals and about fairy tales and about how you don't always get what you want, which is not your Disney movie.
No. Except it is.
Except it is, of course. It is almost entirely sung. Musical lovers love this. I was actually in a production of this as the sound guy, I should point out, way back when, and it is so lovey. I think if you're not into that sort of arch high being sung out, is this on a little bit louder than it should be type musical, then maybe take a step back. It's full on, very singy, and yeah, the word I've got for it is arch. I liked it. I agree with you entirely, Helen. This is the best way they could have done it. They make a couple of neat tweaks to the plot. Because when it goes wrong, by God, does it go wrong. There are bits where you go, well, that's not family entertainment. Think madness, death, which you just don't expect. But yeah, it needs a break. Needs a break. And in the actual stage version, the second half is the second half, whereas in this film, it's the third act.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit rushed at the end, I'd say.
Yeah, they did cut out a few things. The princes have a sort of a reprise of their song, which was lost completely. There was a bit more darkness. I mean, there was worry from Sondheim, among others, that Disney would really file off the edges. And they have a little bit, if we're honest. They've left a lot of stuff kind of unsaid, and you can choose to see it there or not. That's particularly true of Johnny Depp's one scene. If anyone out there hates Johnny Depp, don't worry. He's not in it for very long.
Who would hate Johnny Depp?
People do know him. It happens. But he, in the musical, that's a really charged scene.
Yeah.
And they have softened the edges of that for very understandable reasons, as you'll see when you see it. But yeah, it's... So they've kind of filed off a couple of rough edges, which I think is not a great thing in response to this particular musical, because the rough edges are where it's fun.
But it is kind of amazing that it works.
And yeah, it does.
It's a strange thing to reward a movie for kind of working, but it is a bit of a treat. It does have Meryl Streep. Her opening song is a rap, so bear that in mind. It's that kind of movie. Also, the songs aren't this is my song, these are my feelings. It's that, but also intricate layering of lyrics that feed in and out of each other, that reference back. There's lots of medleys and just a real, it's flair from everyone.
Yeah.
And I don't think there is a weak part in the acting or singing side. I think everyone brings their A game.
I think that's true. I would say I talked to Anna Kendrick shortly after she'd made this, when she was on Pitch Perfect, and she said, after you've sung Sondheim, everything else is easy. The Broadway kind of parody stage show, Forbidden Broadway, does a Sondheim medley, which is called Into the Words, which just emphasizes it. It's actually all about the lyrics. The music is there to prop up the lyrics, which are incredibly intricate and involved. And that's what you really want to listen to, actually, in this case. It's not medleys that you're going to go away singing. It's snatches of words that are going to stick with you.
Excellent. Sounds good. 3 stars for Into the Woods, which, as we all know, is the first recommendation of 2015. So do go check it out if you're into musicals, sung through musicals. I saw Cats this week. Didn't understand what was going on. Doesn't sound like the sort of film for me, but there you go.
I should point out that next week we've got the one and only queen of the everything.
Oh, Helen's back.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep.
Oh.
There is so much goodness in this week's podcast that we've actually asked politely if Meryl wouldn't mind being in next week's podcast. Mm-hmm. And she said, no problem.
Not a problem.
Would you like another cup of tea?
Did she rap?
She did, but I'm not going to impersonate that because she's just too good.
I think in next week's podcast, Meryl Streep will actually be playing Chris and we'll win an Oscar for it. She'll
do a better
job.
She'll do a better job.
But obviously we'll be talking about Into the Woods at length and also her upcoming project where she plays a terrible opera singer.
Ooh.
It's called Florence.
Oh, okay. So look forward to that one. Moving on, let's have another Oscar hopeful, shall we? Foxcatcher, Bennett Miller's Foxcatcher.
Yeah, Foxcatcher is, as you said, another one from Bennett Miller, the man who gave us Moneyball and Capote. It's a very tragic true story. It's a true story with a very much a sting in its tail. It's the story of a man named John DuPont, who in the States was the heir to a huge chemical fortune, the DuPont family. And he is fascinated and driven by the sort of the area of... Well, he's fascinated and driven by sports, but he's mostly fascinated and driven by trying to make America great again. And part of that is driving through sports. His family's always been into hunting and all those sorts of slightly wealthy pursuits. He, however, is fascinated by wrestling, which most of his family tends to sort of look down on a little bit because his mother in particular considers it's a low sport. It's not something that sort of their rich type should be dealing with, but he loves it. He hires, in particular, an Olympic champion wrestler. He hires this guy, Mark Schultz, played by Channing Tatum, to essentially start an academy to train up a load of wrestlers and basically just score Olympic gold and make America proud of its sportsmen. And it frankly all goes a little bit tragically wrong. I probably shouldn't say how. It's a bit of a spoiler, even though it is a true story and the reports are out there. And it's essentially John DuPont is played by Steve Carell, who we all know as Rick Tamland, as we know from Michael Scott from the American version of The Office. And this is such a transformation. It's partly prosthetics, but it's mostly him. He has become this guy, this sort of slightly shambling, but also slightly dangerous, very unhinged in his own way sort of man. That's so completely driven, so focused on what he wants, that it's nothing like you've ever seen Steve Carell before. It's you will almost, there are times you don't think it's Steve Carell. He is actually that good in this performance. And it's the whole film itself is made. Mark Ruffalo also plays Mark Schultz's brother, who is a fellow Olympic wrestler, sort of, a fellow champion wrestler. And it's just this sort of complex intertwining story of these three men and what happens between them.
Mm. It's an interesting film, this, because it's essentially a film about three men who can't express their feelings and who don't talk about anything, really. And there are long periods where it seems like no one is saying anything, or if they are saying anything, it's not what they mean, even slightly. And that, I think, has kind of put some people off. I think it's a little bit hard to warm to because of that. I personally ended up quite liking that because I sort of felt like I knew where they were coming from anyway, for the most part. But I can completely understand some of the criticism the films had, saying that maybe they could have just given us a little bit more just to kind of understand the dynamics. And also, I mean, the true story itself is so dramatic and so shocking that, some of the some of the storytelling maybe kind of downplays the shock in a way that is perhaps, you know, they're too committed to being low key at times. Having said that, I you know, with that was my major problem with it. I felt like they could have gotten to the drama of the affair a little bit earlier. But generally speaking, I thought the performances, especially Tatum, I think, he transforms himself into this, you know, heavy-jawed kind of, you know, guy who shows no real self-confidence beyond his wrestling, very much, you know, depends on first his brother and then DuPont for kind of support and guidance, and is clearly has some, you know, has some serious kind of problems at this time in his life. And I think, you know, it makes you really, really care about him. And I thought Tatum was terrific for me. He was the standout.
This is a film, of course, that's been in the news recently. It's been part of the Oscar race since forever, it seems. Mark Schultz, who's on Twitter as Mark Schultze, recently took to Twitter. He's been very supportive of this film, up to a point, shall we say, because recently he took to Twitter and had a bit of a meltdown, I think is the best way to phrase this, about Bennett Miller, the director, largely typing, I'm going to read out a couple of the tweets, just to give you an idea of how...
All caps, right?
All caps. So picture all caps. I can tolerate a lot of things, but I don't tolerate disrespect. We're done, Bennett. You think I can't take you down with all your rich friends? Punk. Pussy. You want a war? You got it. Many exclamation marks. Die, 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 die. Maybe he's just saying Lee. No evil man could ever speak German. Liar, 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 liar. You crossed the line, Miller. We're done. Your career... career is over. You think I can't do it? Watch me. All of you die. Lying bastards, bastard asshole. So on and so forth. You get the idea. Then he came out in another statement and said that he had been, he felt that he would have been misled and he felt he'd been misled and maybe misportrayed in the movie. And there's a scene in the movie where some people have been reading into that suggests that maybe DuPont and Mark Schultz had a sexual relationship, which he says is absolutely not, did not happen, you know. Now, you know, so it, but now he's come out and he apologized for the meltdown, and we're all friends again, and he's even admitted he's contractually obligated to support the film for another couple of months, which is great. But that aside, the film itself, 4 stars?
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I would like to point out that this movie has been my Captain Phillips, where everyone has said very interesting things about it. I found it interesting. I thought it was well made. I thought everyone in it was good. But I personally found it bloated and boring, and it wasn't my cup of tea. That's not a review saying that this movie didn't work with me, but I honestly couldn't wait for it to end. And when it did end, I found it very anticlimactic. I think, Helen, you put it very well. So personally, if you ever listen to what I'm saying and agree with it on occasion, I didn't like it. I thought it went on, and not much went on when it was going on.
Well, tune in next week for a special segment of the podcast where basically called Ali Hates Nice Things. Puppies.
I'll be reading out Ali's tweets next week.
Puppies are not like Foxcatcher, and by God, they're not like Captain Phillips.
Okay, I'm going to get 2 puppies. I'm going to call 1 Foxcatcher and 1 Captain Phillips, and then we'll see.
Captain Foxcatcher?
Yeah. You think I can't take you down, Captain Foxcatcher? I'll take you down, you and your rich friends. You want a war? You got a war! You puppy, you cute little puppy. All right, lastly, the last film this week, and speaking of the big Oscar contenders, I think this one has it all in the bag.
It really does.
It's the return of Liam Neeson as Brian Mills with his particular set of skills in Taken 3, which Ali and I have seen.
That's correct. It is the story of Brian Mills, retired government operative, who in the previous 2 films has... had his daughter taken and himself taken in the 3rd film in an amazing twist. No one gets taken.
Except the audience.
Hooray!
For a ride!
Yes, it's him in LA with a stuffed panda going to see his daughter, who, of course,
he's teamed up with a stuffed panda.
Is now, yes, it's his buddy cop partnership is now with a stuffed panda. He goes to give a stuffed panda to his quite old now daughter, whose birthday it is. She's still in college, apparently.
She is still in college.
Maggie Grace is 31. Anyway, so he gives Maggie Grace his panda, and Maggie goes, you know what? Bell for this shit. And I'm thinking, so are you, Liam. You promised us on the Empire podcast that this it was inconceivable.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I agree with him. When you compare it to the other Taken movies, I wouldn't say it's the worst, but I think it has a good fight with 2.
Oh, no, it is. For me, it's comfortably the worst. It's one of those movies, it's a bit like, Helen, you said this about when you saw The Love Guru. It made you want to go back and revisit Austin Powers and Wayne's World and just
Yep.
Double check that Mike Myers was funny and those films were funny, because this is so terrible that you can't believe that the first films were good. And I know that a lot of people, you know, I quite like the first Taken. For me, it's a really solid action movie. It was the one that started the Neesonnesence, is what I'm calling it.
Definitely not. We won't allow it, sorry.
Liam Neeson, because he was coming... Anyway, it started his resurgence as an action hero and led to a swathe of copycats and, you know, this whole Jerry Action genre with all the old geezers killing people. You could argue stems from Taken. The Equalizer is pretty much a Taken movie in all but name, for example. And I really like Taken. I think it's got a lot of things wrong with it, but it's got a lot of things right with it. Namely, Brian Mills and a story, a real story where he actually... After 20 minutes of faffing around with a karaoke machine, it finally kicks into gear. He has a great speech. He goes to Paris and he punches and shoots everyone he meets. That's nice and simple.
Yeah.
Second movie was dreadful. And this movie is even worse. And the problem, I think, is Olivier Megaton, the director, who has his last four films. I'm just going to read them out to you now. His last four films, The Transporter 3, awful. Columbiana, awful. Taken 2, dreadful. Taken 3, worst of the trilogy. This man should not be allowed to direct action.
How are we living in a world with a Taken trilogy?
It's the unexpected trilogy of 2015. I honestly feel like this one actually has a plot where it has a beginning, middle and end. Things happen, there are twists, there are turns, action happens. And because it has that, it makes it better than 2, which was just a train wreck where all the different compartments went off into different stations, then exploded separately because someone chucked a grenade outside. This movie, this is faint praise... works.
Well, this movie is a fugitive, but it's a fugitive written by idiots and directed by a man who doesn't know how to direct an action sequence. Just an amazing interview. I think Film Divider did an interview this week with Olivier Megaton, and who I've interviewed before, and he's a very nice guy, and, you know...
He's enthusiastic.
He's enthusiastic. He means well. But the first question in the interview was literally, what's the difference as a director? What's the difference between a good action sequence and a bad action sequence? And his answer, I'm not making this up, is, I don't know, you tell me. I don't know. And he literally can't articulate it. So, yeah, the problem that this film has is that it's extraordinarily dull. And it completely misses the point of what made Brian Mills so popular first time around. And the fact is that Liam now, bless him, I wouldn't mess with him still, but you get the sense that the movie's having to, you know, put some sticking plaster over certain things that he can no longer do. He's not really a fan of running, so what do? You write a film where he runs for a lot of the time. And this is by his own admission. He says he can't run very well. He doesn't like running very, very well. He likes the punching stuff and the punching and the kicking and the shooting at the people. And this movie holds that back for ages. You get a really, really dull plot with Forest Whitaker as a rubbish version of Tommy Lee Jones from The Fugitive trying to hunt down Brian Mills. But because it takes ages to get to the real bad guy, and see if you can spot the real bad guy, fans, when the real bad guy shows up for the first time. it may not be that difficult to spot. It's a bit of a muddle. It's a bit of a mess, and it takes ages to kick in. There's maybe two decent fight sequences, Ali?
It's a tough one, yeah. When he's in an enclosed space, like in the end of Taken, when he's tied to that overhead pipe, that is interesting. I like that a lot. They only do that maybe twice.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work, and... I don't think there was demand for this one, but I guess I'll be proved wrong when it comes out and everyone goes and watches it.
And then we're back here talking about Taken 4 with Olivia Megaton in a couple of years' time.
Yeah, I'm not saying... I just wish it wasn't directed by him, and that I want the Brian Mills character doing something great directed by someone else with a different script.
Don't you feel it? Do you remember, I think in the first film, there was that bit where he talks to his old buddies?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why did they never go back to the old buddies?
Oh, the old buddies are a big part of this.
They're back with a vengeance. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, then
I take it all back. That didn't solve the problem.
To say more about them would make you realise just how ludicrous this is. Because if I explain to you how they get involved, wow. Yeah, it's both preposterous, but not preposterous enough.
Yeah.
It's a funny film. I agree that it does have patches that are just
It's got a couple of decent patches. There's got a couple of things that are going for it. It's a 2-star film. It's not a 1-star write off.
Oh no,
but
no,
it is pretty bad. But I think this is a film that's been cobbled together. For example, there's a really weird bit where Brian Mills, who is an unkillable ghost at this point, you can just appear beside people without any warning, which is just totally ridiculous. Not even Jack Reacher can do that, honestly. Hijacks a car driven by someone. Right, and he goes to a liquor store for reasons that I can't go into. And when we get to the liquor store, we see that the person he's hijacked, and this is weird, maybe this is something just I'm picking up on, but he's played by Wallace Langham, who is Hodges in CSI, right? And was also in the Larry Sanders Show and is a very, very funny guy. Now, he's been in CSI long enough now to be a guy that you cast in a film to be funny and sardonic.
He's a character.
And he doesn't have a single line. He's just sitting there in the car at gunpoint held by Baron Mills looking terrified and then just leaves the film. And you just get this feeling that there was a much longer version where he was like, oh, are you taking me to a liquor store? Are you drunk or something? Ha, ha, ha. Oh, no, you're not drunk. You've got a gun. And that, to me, epitomises how much of a muddle this film is.
Ah, it gets worse. It's a 12A. So you thought this might have some blood and punch and guts and whatever. Okay, so it takes a while to get there, but we're going to get the real fist in jaw, eyes out of sockets. Great. No, you don't. In fact, I actually think I saw a version earlier on which was a little bit more enthusiastically violent. I think it's been neutered out yet more. It's also telling that this was embargoed very much until release. I know that doesn't mean anything, but just so you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is a 12A washout.
Just, you know, one last thing about that point, because we spent too much time on Taken 3, more time than it deserves, which is a real shame again. Yeah, you're absolutely right. One of the things I loved about the first Taken, and the first Taken had a really weird kind of history. It actually was meant to go straight to video in the States and was actually then became a huge hit around the world. And then they released it in the States and everyone seemed to love it. But we over here got the sort of uncensored hardcore version. That's what I loved about it. And it seems weird to me now in a world where we have action movies like The Raid and The Raid 2 and their influence in other action movies. For example, The Equalizer, I mentioned again. Whatever you may think of that film, it didn't pull its punches when it came to the violence. It was unashamedly, unabashedly R-rated. And you get a feeling with Taken 2 and Taken 3 that it'd be much better if they just, you know, let the blood flow a little bit. 2 stars then for Taken 3, which is not a recommendation. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast in association with Squarespace. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Alicia Vikander, the wonderful star of Ex Machina, and, as you've already heard, a young newcomer by the name of Meryl Streep, for whom we're predicting great things. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
There you are. It's goodbye from Ali.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from Jaime Blanco, James White.
See you all next year. Flights are expensive.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to try a bowl full of Jellicle. See you guys next week.